anything that they did, you're capable of doing as well. Yeah. And so we need to make sure that the young people see this, that it's not papered over in school, not papered over by NOVA or National Geographic or any of these other programs, but the evil roots, not of evolution, broadly speaking, but the evil roots of Darwinian selectionist thinking.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Creation Podcast, the show where we discuss the science that confirms Scripture. I'm your host, Trey. I'm sure you've noticed by the title of this particular podcast that the topic we'll be discussing can be a sensitive one. So I just wanted to give a heads up that we will be discussing things like genocide, eugenics, racism, and other adjacent topics during this podcast and the next two podcasts as they take part in a three-part series. So I just wanted to make you aware. It is imperative that we discuss these very real historical events, though, and the cultural and scientific climate that kind of allowed these events to happen. So without wasting any more time, let's begin. From 1941 to 1945, Nazi Germany and its allies systematically murdered 6 million Jews in a genocide known as the Holocaust. At the time, that was approximately two-thirds of Europe's Jewish population. Alongside the Jews, others who had been deemed inferior also suffered at the Nazis' reign. This included the Roma, the Polish, those of Slavic descent, black people, the mentally unwell, and the physically handicapped. But why? To what end? In this three-part series, we're going to take a look at the roots of the Holocaust from a scientific perspective, as well as the Darwinian undercurrent that allowed all of these things to take place. And I have with me today my guest, Dr. Randy Galuza, president of the Institute for Creation Research. Thank you for being here.
Oh, it's always always a delight to be on this program.
Good. Well, I hope you're not too delighted about this one. We'll be talking about some heavy stuff, but again, it's absolutely imperative that we do talk about these things. Off the bat, when we think of the Holocaust, the name that comes to mind is Hitler. And in this first part of the series, I really want to emphasize Hitler was kind of the main orchestrator of the Holocaust, but he did not do it alone. The social, academic, and medical establishments of the day had to be set up for that to even occur. So why is it that culture plays such a huge role when we're talking about something like the Holocaust?
It does, because none of us operate in a vacuum. We all have a worldview. And everyone's a little bit different, of course, but they get shaped. They get shaped during formative years or during traumatic times. And for Adolf Hitler, it was shaped during World War I in many ways, when evolutionary thinking, or what was called the rise of social Darwinism, was taking shape. And that really gripped his mind, not just his, of course, but he had the skills, as we obviously saw later, to influence an entire country with his worldview, which is fundamentally based on the outworking of Charles Darwin's theory of natural selection.
Right. And so along those lines, I'd like to discuss some of the philosophers and thought leaders that kind of led to that. And it goes way back. I mean, he didn't come up with these ideas on his own. So it's kind of interesting to see. First off, I want to discuss Arthur Schopenhauer. And he wrote a particular book that I think is important that Hitler carried with him during World War I. Can you share anything about that?
Yes. This was an interesting book, which actually predated Darwin's thoughts altogether. And that's because some of the things that Darwin was thinking about survival of the fittest, were not unique to him. What he added to them was this whole idea of the struggle to survive. And this gentleman that you just mentioned, he had that same idea as well. And in fact, he even believed that you could inherit your intellect. You would inherit intellect and other properties from your parents as well. And he wrote a very influential book, as you mentioned, that Hitler carried with him throughout all of World War I. And I think that you even had in mind that there was a particular thought that really seized his thinking.
Yeah, I have a quote here from his book. "The World as Will and Representation" is the title of the book. But this is eugenics at its core. He says, "If you want utopian plans, I would say the only solution to the problem is the despotism of the wise and noble members of a genuine aristocracy, a genuine nobility, achieved by mating the most magnanimous men with the cleverest and most gifted women. This proposal constitutes my utopia and my Platonic Republic." What do we get from that? What do we learn from that?
Well, obviously, he held to a type of eugenics, which we would have called positive eugenics, mm-hmm. in the sense that he's not, at least in this particular quote that you're mentioning here, thinking about eliminating unfit people or sterilizing them and those kinds of things. The positive type of eugenics was the selective breeding, where somebody picks the best traits that they want. Mm-hmm. In this particular case, it was the cleverest women in these cases, because he believed that you inherited your intellect from your mother and your character traits from your father.
And so he's trying to develop, I guess, technically good people using this method, which is not true, but
right. We in retrospect, we know it's not true on that, but at the time, people really thought it was true, and they really thought it would be very, very effective, that you would control the development. And I don't know whether this gentleman was thinking in terms of the overall evolution of humanity at that time, but that you would control the trajectory of it by selectively breeding. So that thought of there's a higher, a fitter group of people, there's lesser people, and you want to benefit humanity through a type of eugenics, those seeds were planted in Hitler's mind at that time.
Okay. And that was pretty early on, because World War I, but we don't often think, when we think of Hitler, we think of World War II, but he was in World War I as well, and played a pretty large role in his development of his thinking, which led to what happened later. I think that the next person that we're going to talk about doesn't really need any introduction. Of course, Charles Darwin, who I think that oftentimes we think about, you know, The Origin of Species, his first book, which established, you know, the theory of evolution, sort of, from a very theoretical place. But then people are like, well, he doesn't talk about humans there. He only talks about animals. But then he wrote another book, The Descent of Man, which is all about humans. What were his ideas there?
Well, you know, when you start to talk about Darwin, he was a prolific writer, and his thinking ranged far and wide on lots of areas. And, when he does talk about the descent of man and his whole idea in the book of the same title on that, but you really can't divorce that at all from Origin of the Species by any means. And Origin of the Species is clearly one of the most influential books in all of human history, without a doubt. Mm-hmm. There.
Unfortunately.
Yes, and very unfortunately. And but that's why this podcast is so important, because there is a time when the thinking of Charles Darwin and the influence that it had on not only on World War II, but also on World War I and industrial society was completely divorced in the educational setting. I predated you by at least a decade of education, and I never heard of the influence of evolutionary thinking in terms of eugenics, like we just discussed, in terms of the Holocaust. It was always just this Nazi idea, mm-hmm. and that the Nazi idea was evil. And that's because the people who were teaching me still wanted to promote evolutionary thinking. You still want to keep it. And if you can see all of the evils of it, then you're not going to teach the history of those things. But it kept a whole generation, myself and probably you as well, ignorant of what the real damage to Darwin's thinking was at that time. So before we even jump to Descent of Man, let's just talk about what Darwin introduced that was important. Everybody saw that creatures would struggle with each other, and that there was predator and there was prey, and that when climates changed or things changed, that some lived and some died. But Darwin added two things to that observation, which made it distinctly his, and which made it distinctly selectionist or firmly based in natural selection. One, he added Malthus, where he saw organisms as constantly struggling for scarce resources. And he said that in any generation, more offspring would be born than resources available for him, for each of them. And that therefore they would have to struggle for those, one outcompeting another. And therefore it was like a competition where the fittest or the strongest, the best, would survive and the weaklings would die off. Now, from a theoretical standpoint, he needed that in order to get a trajectory to evolution. He didn't want evolutionary change to just be flat. He wants to go from simple to complex. In order to do that, he needs a competition where there's a one-upmanship. So he introduces this Malthusian idea, which was specifically his. And then second, he compared nature to a human breeder. And human breeders will select, and they use their volition and they use their intelligence to pick for one trait over another. And he projected that onto nature. And nobody was doing that prior to Darwin, so that nature became this personified agent, selecting the best. And sometimes he personified it very strongly, where he said natural selection was daily and hourly scrutinizing the entire world, every organism at every time, and unfailingly picking the best and eliminating the weak.
That sounds like almost like a deity. You know, that description is very much a description of not a good deity, but a deity nonetheless.
That's right. And yes, an omniscient, omnipresent, all-powerful deity that's searching through everything. Yeah. And to just sum it all up, you know, Darwin basically said this, as I quoted, I'm just reading from Origin of the Species about page 74, if someone was looking at that. As many more individuals of each species are born than can possibly survive, and as, consequently, there is a frequently recurring struggle for existence, we shall then see how, and this is the important part, Trey, natural selection almost inevitably causes much extinction of the less improved forms of life.
That's what the Nazis intended to do. That was the whole goal. And it's just, it's kind of scary that this line in this book that has been so influential could lead to something like that.
Yeah, it can be foot stomped hard enough that selectionism is a worldview. Mm-hmm. It's a worldview that's based on death, extinction, one-upmanship, survival of the fittest, and it cannot be divorced from its historical roots of being tied to death by any means. Ernst Mayr, he recently passed away, but he was a prominent evolutionist, and in 2001, he wrote his definitive work on what evolution is, and he basically said in his definition of natural selection, quote, the process by which in every generation, individuals of lower fitness are removed from the population.
And so from there, it's almost like they took this idea of, you know, nature, and that's in quotes for those who aren't watching the video, nature is already doing this. We can speed up the process. We can do it. We can remove those that we deem unfit.
That's right. And there's a moral angle to it as well. I mean, if nature is doing this, and if the process of nature doing this led to humanity, the highest organism, then how can it be bad? And in fact, at the time, the thinking was creeping in that to preserve unfit people and to keep them alive, that was the immoral action. And this thinking was turning that on its head by saying, It's really the moral thing to do, and consistent with the history of nature, to eliminate the unfit from every population. And so, of course, people weren't really doing that, but that was planting the seeds. That was planting the seeds in Hitler's mind that this is the natural course of life.
And we saw how that played out. But we'll get to that. We'll get to that. Okay, so this natural course of life, it's not just animals. It does apply to humans too, according to Charles Darwin in The Descent of Man. Does he have anything to say about like superiority as far as like, I guess, racially motivated? I'm just curious because we know that a lot of the Nazis' push to eliminate the unfit was racially motivated. What does he have to say about people?
Yes. It's clearly racially motivated. And as you mentioned, The Descent of Man is really where he elaborated all his ideas on that. So way back, early on in his book, The Descent of Man, he states the purpose, the premise of it. And he says, the sole object of this work is to consider, firstly, whether man, like every other species, is descended from some pre-existing form. Secondly, the manner of his development. And thirdly, the value of the differences between the so-called races of man. Mm. And then he added a few pages later that it must be inquired whether man, like so many other animals, has given rise to varieties and subraces differing but slightly from each other, or to races differing so much that they must be classed as doubtful species. And then he brings that whole idea to its logical conclusion, whether the humans, and he's going to go that way, that we really will be classified into almost separate species, that there is a major difference between these races. And therefore, later in his book, he said that the civilized races of man will almost certainly exterminate, replace, throughout the world, the savage races. And then later in a compilation of his letters by his son, he said simply, very, very bluntly, looking to the world at no very distant date, what an endless number of the lower races will have been eliminated by the higher civilized races throughout the world.
It's honestly like, it's sickening. I mean, it is sickening at its core. But it's just like from that very foundation, you know, and we come from a different worldview. And so our worldview, which we will talk about later in this series, is that, you know, humans are equal. We're made in the image of God. So this is so counter to my worldview, to your worldview. And I think like to a lot of people's worldview at the time, it was like a slow creep. It was, oh, if we can kind of point here and point there and point here and point there. And then it's like almost like a brainwashing of convincing people that this was true.
Right. And it's the convincing of them that it's true, but you also have to convince them that it's moral.
Yeah. That it's right.
That it's right. And it's the right thing to do. And that, that you are able to placate your conscience in some way when you exterminate somebody. And, you know, we have a different worldview because we follow Christ. But there are a lot of people, even younger than you, who have a different worldview today because thinking like this, that one race of people is going to exterminate a less civilized race, is so foreign to them too.
Yeah.
And I'm glad it is, and I know you're glad it is too, that this type of thinking has been shown for the evil that it is, even though it's certainly not eliminated from society.
Right.
But what the purpose of the podcast is to educate these younger people as to the roots. Mm-hmm. Because if you don't educate the younger people, one, they won't see the evil of evolutionary thinking and how it creeps into a person's worldview like Hitler's and all of these other leaders.
Right.
And two, if you don't see it, you're liable to repeat it because no matter who you are really not better than the people in the generations before you. And anything that they did, you're capable of doing as well. And so we need to make sure that the young people see this, that it's not papered over in school, not papered over by NOVA or National Geographic or any of these other programs, but the evil roots, not of evolution, broadly speaking, but the evil roots of Darwinian selectionist thinking, the selectionist worldview is brought out, and how that was the seed for Hitler's thinking, that this was right, and all of his colleagues, and that they were doing nature's work.
And doing the right thing, which alongside that, we actually have, next we have one of Darwin's own relatives, his half-cousin, Sir Francis Galton, who also, I mean, it must run in the family somehow, because he pioneered eugenics. So we already talked about positive eugenics a little bit when we talked about Arthur Schopenhauer. But what was Galton trying to get across to people?
Well, Galton, like all the people in the eugenics program, were trying to control the evolution of humanity. And they were trying to replace the ruthless action of natural selection, or we could almost say natural selection, in eliminating the unfit, leading to humanity. And Galton was concerned that through medical interventions and other scientific interventions, that we were preserving those people who would naturally die. And not only was Galton there, but Carl Pearson, another prominent British eugenicist at the time, were holding the medical community, almost taking them to task, I should say, not really holding them accountable, but taking them to task for saving people that really shouldn't have been saved, and preserving them and giving them the potential to reproduce, and therefore perpetuating unfit and less and traits that would be less desirable for humanity at that time. And therefore, Galton, Pearson, and others started to implement what were viewed as negative eugenics. And that is not just trying to breed from your best, but to forcibly sterilize people they deemed inferior, or to euthanize people, generally very, very young or old, who were useless eaters and taking from society and not contributing anything back from them. So that led to the whole, and we actually had a separate podcast on this. I think the title was Don't Trust This Man, or something like that.
Yes.
The whole, everything that we discussed in our other podcast on all of the eugenics movement that took place during that time. So in England, you had and in the United States as well, you had the rise of the eugenics movements, which were taking place during the early 1900s all the way through the 1930s, and were contributing to this worldview that Hitler was going to build on. Though Hitler didn't really like to study that much directly from the British people like Darwin and Galton and Pearson and things. He listened to other Germans, but other Germans were listening to these British scholars.
And it's interesting that you state that, you know, some of these ideas were emanating from Britain. And when we think, we're like, oh, the Holocaust, you know, the ideas were purely German, I guess, or purely Nazi. No, it was there from other nations. And we talked about on that eugenics podcast, which we'll link right here, you know, that America played a large role in that as well. And so those are in World War II, depending on how you look at things, both sides were participating in this horrible act. Yeah.
Yeah, it was terrible. People forget that in the United States, we forcibly sterilized. You know, you have to put the word in. You know, it's like we sterilized. No, we forcibly sterilized against people's will over 70,000 Americans.
Wow. Yeah. And they don't teach you that in school, or maybe they do now. They didn't, you know, when I was in school. So, all right. So eugenics. We then have Ernst Haeckel, which we have a podcast about Ernst. We'll link it here. He was, we've talked about him at length in that other podcast, but he was a German zoologist and naturalist, a huge, huge fan of Darwin. And he was the one who made the Haeckel's embryos, which we did talk about, you know, showing that, oh, a human, you know, when it's developing in the womb, goes through all of its stages of evolution, right? And so I think that that leads to this idea that we're just animals, right? Do you have any thoughts on that?
Yes. You know, it all goes back to the moral realm. How are you going to get someone to do dastardly things to another person without their conscience just bothering them or refusing to do those kinds of things? Not in an extremist situation where you're holding their family at gunpoint or doing things like this. How do you get them to actually go out and march and want to do that and to think that they're doing right? This is so important. Every generation could do it. Even the youngest today, you would do well to listen closely how the teachings of a man who basically was equating humans with other animals influenced the thinking of the major leaders of the Third Reich at that time. And as you said, his drawings and the whole evolutionary idea is that humans are nothing but just another animal. And some people today would say not even really a more highly evolved animal, but just one of other animals as well. And of course, we eat animals.
Right.
We take them to market. We have seafood. We have all these other kinds of things.
We keep them as pets, which implies that they're lower than
that's
us.
That's right. And that's it. We keep them. We are the masters. We own these pets and things like that. So that idea that humans are just one of them and just another one of them is very important that you plant that thinking in someone's mind if you want them to go out and willingly do something to another person or to another animal.
This kind of led to the stratification of humans. You know, we call them humans. He would just think of them as animals. And I have this quote. He was a leading proponent of scientific racism, which is, from my understanding, you know, racism not just out of hatred, but racism because science says so, right?
Right.
And so he says, the Caucasian or Mediterranean man has from time immemorial been placed at the head of all the races of men as the most highly developed and perfect. It is generally called the Caucasian race, but as among all the varieties of the species, the Caucasian branch is the least important. We prefer the much more suitable appellation proposed by Friedrich Müller, namely that of Mediterranese. For the most important varieties of the species, which are moreover the most eminent actors in what is called the universal history, first rose to a flourishing condition on the shores of the Mediterranean. This species alone, with the exception of the Mongolian, has had an actual history. It alone has attained to that degree of civilization which seems to raise men above the rest of nature. So from reading that, it's like, hey, you know, Caucasian, which is, you know, that's not a word that we use super frequently, but it's like white people, right? But it's like, no, not just white people. This subcategory of white people, Mediterranean, this species is the only one with a history. This species is the only one of really any historical value, which is just mind-blowing to me to just negate all the other people groups of the world. And of course, we wouldn't call them races, you know, ethnicities and geologic people groups. Do you have anything to say to that?
Well, sure. I mean, that's the first step to getting people to do dastardly things to other people is you start to divide. You start to divide into groups. And in this particular case, he's dividing humanity into higher groups and lower groups, not just different groups today. And you completely marginalize them by discounting them almost as human beings, as less fit human beings, as you just already mentioned, no contributions culturally, historically in any way, and that As Darwin was already saying, the civilized races must soon, shortly exterminate the less civilized races. So you see all of the pieces being moved into place of division, which is going to lead to looking down, which is going to lead to hatred of other groups and the extermination of those groups. Another piece which was being moved into place, which is important, is the sanction of science. I mean, if science is telling us that this is the way it is, then one, it must be true, because the scientific method leads us to true. But it also must be right, because you know, science is the natural course of things, so it leads us to truth and the right actions. So these pieces were being moved into place to get people to think. And I keep emphasizing that. It's not just Hitler, and it's not just the fellow leaders. You have to get it, an entire country.
To be okay with it.
To be okay with it. You've got to get an entire country to stand up at rallies and shake their fists and stomp their feet in anger and hatred. You've got to get loads of people who are willing to break glass and destroy things. And if you that's on the affirmative side of what they're trying to do. And on the negative side, you at least want the others to shut up and be silent and to be intimidated or be so morally ambivalent that they're not going to say something.
It's not bothering me, therefore I won't do anything about it.
Right.
Wow. Okay. So Haeckel also did this thing. So Darwin proposed these biological theories. And at the time, these theories were also being pushed into the social realm, the economic realm. And so social Darwinism attempts to apply these biological concepts like natural selection, which of course we don't agree with, but at the time it had infiltrated everything and still does. And the idea of survival of the fittest to sociology, economics, and politics. What did that lead to?
Wow. We could do separate podcasts on every one of those topics as well. So social Darwinism, or when someone says something is Darwinian, what they really mean is survival of the fittest, or as we said earlier, one-upmanship, where you step on the person below you in order to get ahead, and there's nothing wrong with stepping on that person. If they weren't weak, they wouldn't be stepped on.
Right.
And in order to advance, you need to step on them, and you certainly don't want them perpetuating their kind in the population, so you want to eliminate them, so you do it, and there's nothing wrong with doing it.
In fact, it's good. You have the moral high ground there.
That's right. You have the moral high ground. So you, if you use ruthless actions to run competitors out of business in the business realm, well, that was just the way it was according to nature. That was very Darwinian. And I remember reading just maybe about a year ago, I won't even mention the company, but it's a very prominent company in the United States, where people who were working for that company at the executive level and the upper echelons of management said the entire company was, quote, Darwinian. That, and this was just a year or so ago, that this whole idea that you step on the person next to you, you undermine them in some way in order to get ahead. And that's the way the company was operating, and the upper management wanted it that way because they felt that that fostered a better executive core within the department as well. So it hasn't gone away.
Wow. Don't want to work for that company. Okay, and so we've got all these pieces kind of building up together in this time, and then I want to talk about Sigmund Freud. You know, you hear about him a lot. He is a neurologist and psychoanalysis, and he did all sorts of stuff in the realm of psychology. But it's not just psychology, because we have to be clear, psychology can be used for good. But he took, you know, kind of like others were doing to the social realm, he took this Darwinian thought process and pushed it into the psychological realm. So how did that work?
Right. And just to emphasize, you know, we have medical doctors who are psychiatrists who work very, very closely with psychologists, and they treat people with mental illnesses, which are real illnesses. Mm-hmm. They're as real as any physical illness that you might have in any other way. And they do a lot of good. And I have been with groups of us where we have put together treatment plans for people and used psychology and psychologists in an incredibly good way mm-hmm. on that. But Freud, like so many other people of the day, brought in these racist ideas. He brought in Darwin's thinking into psychology. And it's still here. It hasn't left. It has just morphed into what's now called evolutionary psychology. And evolutionary psychology tries to explain the origins of people's behaviors, or why we do things the way we do them. Mm. And it's always based on the idea that we are just another animal. So if you want to know how we got to the place we are today, well, you watch other animals, particularly what are considered our closest evolutionary relatives, that is chimpanzees and other primates, and you watch how they behave. And that will tell you, according to evolutionary psychology, why we do what we do. Mm-hmm. And in some ways, it's the same sanction. Well, we do the things we do because it was the struggle to survive which led us in our competition or evolutionary past to do this, which then also leads some to think, and not just the evolutionary psychologists, but other prominent evolutionists, that there really is no such thing as free will in humans. I mean, if everything is in my brain due to my evolutionary past and it's been ingrained there by the fact that I needed it in order to survive, then are my decisions based on a type of free volition where I have a choice between these things, or am I constrained? Am I constrained in my thinking by this evolutionary past that even if I don't want to, even if I could think I didn't want to, would I make any other decision in any other way?
And people, even that brought to mind, people use it almost like flippantly. I hear it said, oh, my lizard brain made me do that. Like, that's the phrase that I hear, you know, implying that we evolved from reptiles at some point in the past. And it's like, your mind is an incredible thing. Not yours. Well, yours in particular. But I mean, the human mind is an incredible thing. And we've kind of pushed it to the side and been like, it's just the way it is because that's how it evolved, which is very sad because we have creativity and we're not lizard-brained people. So it's just kind of taken over culture, even at like the pop culture level.
Yeah, and it's in medical school.
Yeah.
There are certain portions of your brain are considered more primitive than others, and other parts are considered advanced. Names in medical textbooks still bear that whole idea of the early brain and the more advanced brain, and it really leads people astray. Mm-hmm. But in terms of evolutionary psychology, it's another piece of the puzzle that needed to be put into place because you really want to, you're not really trying to control behavior. You want to get people to behave willfully and voluntarily to do things that they will see it as the means to good.
And so we still have just a few more people, a few more thought leaders to talk about. We won't spend a ton of time on these few, but we have Eugen Fischer, Erwin Bauer, and Fritz Lenz. They wrote a book called Principles of Human Heredity and Race Hygiene. First off, I want to ask you a question. What does race hygiene mean?
Well, I have no idea.
Oh, okay.
to be honest with you, I can kind of think what they're thinking in terms of hygiene. You want cleansing. You want to get things out. You want to have good hygiene when you're in an operating room and stuff like this. You eliminate the germs. You eliminate the infective things by cleansing it. So I, without having read all their stuff in depth, that's what I think they're talking about, okay, is probably cleansing of the race and keeping it clean from impurities.
And these guys, so they were professors, and we'll talk about that in just a second. But it's important to note that these people were active before the Nazi Party came to be. But two of them joined the Nazi Party, and one of them became the director of the Kaiser Wilhelm Institute of Anthropology, Human Heredity, and Eugenics. So these professors became prominent people in the actual Nazi Party, not just before. So you mentioned that you wanted to discuss something about the professorship of these gentlemen. So where does that lead?
Right. You know, you're building a really good job of showing the links between selectionism, which is the basis of eugenics, this idea that we're going to control the evolution of humanity through selective breeding and the elimination of those, and then the next step, which is going to be the Holocaust, the real widespread implementation of this type of thinking. So you're probably asking, well, wasn't anybody saying this is wrong? Stop. Mm-hmm. We shouldn't be doing this. And the answer is yes. We'll probably get to that in our third episode of there was a small minority of people who were protesting these things, but the vast majority of people who in the United States and Great Britain and over in Germany were going along with these ideas of eugenics and breeding. And you'll have to go to our previous podcast to really learn about that. And that is because they were being taught by professors, and professors at the best universities, and professors who held the highest positions and went to the international conferences on all of these things. And they therefore were conceived of as the smartest and the elite and the ones who we should really be listening to and following. And other professors who would disagree with them were marginalized. They were basically, as we would say today, canceled in one way or another.
Cancel culture existed back then too, yes.
You better believe it did. And they were canceled. The dissenting voices were canceled. And we now know that the dissenting voices were the correct ones as well. But society and young people watching this podcast, this could be you as well, have this tendency to want to let the experts, to want to let the elites lead them and basically tell them the right way of thinking and the right way to behave and how you should interact with your fellow human beings. And we saw this even play out during the recent COVID experience, where we were supposed to let the science speak and listen to the experts and follow the science, even though the science changed from week to week to week of what the mandate was for that week, which might have been the exact opposite of what it was a month ago, along those lines. So there's this idea that the experts should lead the non-experts, and the elites should lead the less elite. Mm-hmm. And that's what these men also brought into the game.
Okay. And then our final thought leader, he's kind of important because he kind of set up this idea of he's a French guy. He's not German. Count Joseph Arthur de Gobineau. I probably butchered that name. I'm not French. Sorry, but he was a racial theorist, and he was one of the first to claim that it was the German races, the Germanic races, that were more culturally and physically evolved. Because we had earlier, you know, the Mediterraneans were the highest race. Caucasians in general were the highest race. But this man said, no, it's the Germans. They're the ones who were at the head of the pack. And so any thoughts on that?
Well, of course, Germans are going to listen to that.
Yes.
That, I mean, why not? And you make an important point. It's nobody from really other races of people who are saying that a race different than theirs,
right,
is the highest one. This is human nature. You're going to point to your own on that. Even though this Frenchman was pointing to the Germanic one, he still was white. He's still part of that group, mm-hmm. and he's still not going to be considered at the very lowest of the low by these people who brought this racial thinking into it. Mm-hmm. But really almost pulling it all together, you're seeing a big melting pot of ideas. Yep. You're seeing a very strong undercurrent of racism that Darwin introduced. You're seeing the idea that not only are there just differences in races, there's a stratification of races. You have the highest and you have the lowest. You have the idea that one needs to dominate over the other and eventually exterminate it altogether. And then you have those thoughts being more and more refined to specific people groups, and you have the stamp of authority of science upon it. Mm-hmm. And all of this is leading to this milieu, which is going to seize Nazi Germany at that time, which is going to culminate, I think we're going to discuss in our next podcast, in the mass extermination and murdering of whole groups of people. The Jewish people that you talked about, but then Slavic people, Russian people, they were also looked down on as inferior. And if they were not hauled off to concentration camps, they were dealt with very brutally by the Germans.
Yeah. It really is all of these thought leaders kind of, all their ideas kind of merge into this perfect storm of, hey, let's take it and run with it. You know, that's where it's headed. But I think before we move on to the Holocaust itself, it's important to talk about how did this subtle shift, we've mentioned it a little bit, but like this shift in mindset, it wasn't instant. It took place over time. And I want to know, did people typically hold survival of the fittest type ideologies before? Like, sure, individuals might have, but like as a whole, was that the general belief, or was this just a slow, like tsunami wave, just pushing everyone in this direction?
Really, following Darwin, it became a tsunami wave within decades. It's not like within a year of having it, like whoosh, it's over. But it was very, very soon. And survival of the fittest still dominates people's thinking today. Mm-hmm. And we still think of fitter animals. In fact, I just did a podcast for another group, and someone asked me a question about reproductive fitness and those kinds of things. So this whole idea of something being fitter than others or being better than others, it still infiltrates all of our thinking. And survival of the fittest mentality, it grips people thinking because at first it seems so obvious. Right. It seems as plain as the nose on your face. You know, the fittest ones will survive. Those with the traits that are suitable or better or whatever are the ones that are going to survive. Obviously, the reason why it seems as obvious as the nose on your face is because it's just a tautology. Mm-hmm. The ones that are the fittest survived, and how do you know that they were the fittest? It's because they survived, and why did they survive? It's because they were the fittest, and how do you know? It's just circular thinking. That's why it's plain as a nose on your face. All it's saying is survivors survive, and dyers die. Right. Well, that's why it's plain there. But the social element of it grips everybody's mind. And it's almost as if, because of our sinful nature that is deep down inside there, it just takes a little bit of opening the bottle or opening the can to give you a socially sanctioned reason for letting that sinfulness out. Mm-hmm. And not keeping it under wraps. And then when it gets out, it explodes to all of the inhumanity that humans can do towards each other as that we can even imagine.
Right. And so before we end, I just want to ask, is this the natural end game for evolution? It really seems that there's a loss of humanity here. There's a loss of really any sort of morality. Because in this view, humans are just animals. So is this just the natural end game of evolution?
It's a natural end game of selectionism.
Okay.
Evolution's way too broad. It encompasses too many ideas.
Okay.
To just say evolution. And someone could push back against us by saying, well, you know, evolution doesn't teach this and evolution doesn't teach this. But Darwinian selectionism is a different framework. It's foundational to evolutionary thinking. And Darwinian selectionism, at its roots, can be and historically always will be a death-driven worldview. We have Stephen Jobs giving a commencement address at Stanford University, and he's dying of pancreatic cancer, and he's kind of relating what he's learned from this journey to his soon impending death. And he says, death is very likely the single best invention of life. It's life's change agent. And so the answer to your question is yes. Selectionist thinking is always survival of the fittest, one-upmanship, and there is nothing wrong in that worldview with the extermination of the less fit.
Okay. Well, that's a lot. It's a lot to take in. You know, it's a lot to talk about and to even think about. And so before we just draw the final closing thoughts, do you have anything that you'd like to share with our listeners and viewers?
Yes. This can happen to any of us. You know, we're talking about what happened in Germany at that time. But deep down inside, we all have feelings of hatred. We all have a sinful nature. We all tend to divide. And so nobody should think of themselves as immune. There's no cause for any of us to virtue signal that I'm not like this person or I'm not like that,
right?
Because we are. And when all of the parts come together and it starts to seize the thinking of an entire society, survival of the fittest, as we'll see in our next episode, it really bears some ugly fruit. So our podcast is not just a history lesson. Our podcast is a warning. It's a warning to young people today. This could happen to you, and you need to know, you need to be aware of the history, and you need to know the roots of the thinking that led to this Holocaust. And it goes right back to Darwinian selectionism.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much for joining me for this podcast. It is such an important topic, and I look forward to seeing what we're going to talk about next. So thank you. And thank you to all of our listeners and viewers for joining us. We hope that this episode was just informative, despite the heaviness of the topic. We hope that it can be encouraging to you, that you can take this information and use it elsewhere. If you would, please like, share, subscribe. And if you want to get this podcast, the Creation Podcast, a week early, or our monthly podcast, Creation.Live, 2 weeks early, you can become a member here on YouTube or on Patreon. And we really just want to emphasize that this is a big deal. We're not just talking about this because we want to talk about it. We're talking about it because it affects every part of our everyday lives. So we just encourage you to tune in again next week as we talk about the atrocities of the Holocaust and all that went along with it. And then in the third episode, we're going to talk a little bit about the hope that we have going beyond those historical events. So we'll see you next time on the Creation Podcast.